Hello and welcome to Tournament Magic for November 18, 2012. It's 6 p.m. GMT / 1 p.m. EST. We are a bi-weekly podcast and internet show covering topics of science, skepticism, and atheism. I'm the Kitch 2, my co-host tonight, the ever-sexy Zulu Fight Runner.
Hey, welcome. Hi, everyone.
And the just awesome Martimer 81.
Hey.
We'll be taking questions from the chat room, so if you have to call in, Skype contact phone number logic, giving your name, location, and general overview of your question. Please note that the show is recorded for later uploading, so by calling in, you're granting the permission to use your likeness. If you have further questions, we can be reached by email, Twitter, and Facebook via the links in the playgrounds below. If you have any further questions, so I will now hand over to Zulu, who will introduce tonight's special guest.
Thank you very much, Kutch. Tonight's guest received his bachelor's degree in journalism from Temuk University and his master's degree from Harvard School of Public Health. He has then since written many stories for CBS Health Watch and the Washington Post. Since 2006, he has written the column Bad Medicine for Life Science. He has also worked as an astronomy writer, working at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, and freelance for such magazines as Sky and Telescope and Astronomy Magazine. He is currently the armchair astrophysics columnist for the Astronomical Society of Pacific's Mercury magazine. He's also the author of a few books, Bad Medicine, Misconceptions and Misissues Revealed, From Distance Healing to Vitamin O, from 2003, and Food at Work, Workplace Solutions for Malnutrition, Obesity and Chronic Diseases. The latter book has been lauded by unions and nutritionists, inspiring government food legislation to improve worker food programs in places such as Mexico, Lithuania and Uruguay. His most recent book, which will be the focus of tonight's show, Hey Einstein, A Novel About Nature and Nurture, is really his first foray into fiction and asks the question, nature v. nurture, what would have become of Albert Einstein if he had been raised in any other settings? And it also explores issues of cloning and genetics. So as we're doing an online show, you can't really put your hands together for our guests, so in whatever chat room you're watching this tonight, please give a thumbs up for our guest, Christopher Wanjek.
Hey, well, thank you for that nice introduction. It might actually sound a bit confusing. It sounds like I do a lot, and I guess I do have a lot of different jobs going on. But at heart, as Cal said, I'm a health and science writer. I don't claim to be an expert in any given field, but what I like about science writing is meeting with experts and talking to experts and try to translate what they're saying into things that other people can understand. So what I'm hoping to do tonight is kind of present this idea that I have about Einstein and whether he would still be an Einstein if raised in quote-unquote less than ideal settings, and how much does nature influence intelligence, and how much does nurture influence intelligence? I presented to skeptics before, and so I must admit you guys are an intimidating lot, and that's it's because you know a lot, and you're really good with the facts, and I think for the most part you know more than me, the so-called expert on this given topic. So that's why I'm going to want to hear your thoughts about what I'm going to be saying, yes or no to this core question about Einstein and intelligence. Maybe I'll just go to this first slide that I presented. It's a very limited presentation here today. I just wanted to put up some eye candy of sorts. And the first thing I wanted Cal to show you guys was this poster from the movie Twins, 1988 poster. I don't know if you remember this movie. It's a movie that really had didn't need any more explanation beyond Arnold Schwarzenegger, Danny DeVito, twins. You know, it was a funny enough premise to go on with that these people could possibly be twins. And the premise, which of course makes no sense to any skeptic crowd, is that scientists wanted to create some type of you know, Wunderkind, and so they use six sperm from six intelligent men and combined it with an egg of a woman. But twins were somehow born, and the experiment was halted, and they didn't know what to do at this point. And so it's silly at a very basic level, of course, but there are some interesting things that come out of this. And I didn't even remember this movie as I started writing my novel. But it is interesting that the Schwarzenegger character, he's the taller, good-looking, smarter, stronger of the twins. He is raised by one of the scientists on some South Pacific island, taught 12 languages, the whole works. And one other interesting little point is that he's told that his mother died in childbirth. And the Danny DeVito character, he's raised in an orphanage. He ends up being kind of streetwise, but this is interesting to me too. He's told that his mother abandoned him. So from the very beginning, these kids have some level of negativity and positivity into their life. One told that his mother abandoned him, and of course, being runt-like, he has certain negative feelings all growing up, and the other guy is kind of godlike and told that his mother happened to die, but maybe he can live on. So he had that kind of influence going on there. But again, that didn't influence my book. I just kind of realized that later. Let's go on to the next slide. And these are twins. I don't know if you can see the slides, but it's pretty basic. One, maybe I don't even have my slides open, but I remember this, of course, because I gave it to Cal. One is there are two mice, two sets of mice. It's the same experiments that are done from Andy Jordal's lab. I've met this fellow. He's at Duke University in North Carolina. These mice, for those who can't quite see it, one is huge and orange and kind of orange fur. And one is a little brown mouse, like you would normally expect. And they are twins. They are clones. They are genetically identical. It's just fascinating. And on the slide, there's another one, too, the same idea. One's big, one's small. And what's happening here is something called epigenetics going on. So these mice are clones, but the clones themselves were implanted in two different mothers, two different mother mice, and the mice themselves had different diets. And that radically changed the outcome of the life of the mice that would be born. It's an epigenetic concept. Epigenetics is like the window above genetics. Genetics are supposed to determine everything about you, but that's not really the case. It's a misunderstanding. It's the influences during life that turn on and turn off genes. And given a very bad diet to that mother, one of the mothers who will eventually give birth to the huge mouse, they were able to turn off a certain gene that would otherwise control for obesity. And so when these mice were born, they were fed more or less the same diet, but they were so genetically altered during their development that they became two radically different animals, not twins at all, much like the so-called twins in that Hollywood film. But this itself didn't. I found this later, of course, as I was writing this book. But what really started me on this concept of Einstein and intelligence and how much is a factor is a conversation I was having with my stepdad. Now, my first father, my father, he died over 20 years ago now. I was somewhat young. And he died about age 60. And his father died around age 49, heart disease, diabetes, the whole works. And they had horrible, horrible diets. And, you know, no one knew anything, and they just drank bacon grease for breakfast or whatever. You know, they just horrible food that they would engulf. And but my stepdad is quite different. And I was having this conversation with him about what he thought about Einstein, whether or Einstein, if raised in any other situation, would still be an Einstein. And he said yes. You know, this old theory that cream rises regardless of what's happening. And I felt no. So I wanted to create my own little experiment of sorts in the form of a novel, because I'm not a scientist, I'm just a writer, and the novel becomes my little laboratory. So I decided, and it was a lot like a science experiment. I figured I'd create some characters in a literary fashion. I didn't really know the outcome of this story. I just had a certain inclination that I feel that nurture is more important than nature in developing not only how a person looks and acts, but also the very intelligence of that person. So I began writing this book, and that's what I'm going to want your input on. It's kind of a funny book. I'm not saying go out and buy it. I think for the most part, it's probably a bad book. But the middle part lags a bit. The beginning and the ending are great. They're kick-ass, so you should read it for that much. But it's kind of funny here that, you know, there's an evil genius who wants to take over the world, and he seizes the world's finances with a computer code that's based on Einstein's general relativity. And, you know, they're gathered, of course, all the generals are gathered together in a White House. This is clearly an American perspective here. And they don't know what to do about it. They're thinking, man, you know, this is going to take an Einstein to crack this code. And then the CIA remembers, oh, wait, right, yeah, we cloned Einstein about 30 years ago. But, you know, Nixon came to power, and he wanted to clone hippies instead of Einstein to better understand the hippies. So we ran out of funding, and we had to put these kids up for adoption. We don't even know what happened to them. They were raised probably in less than ideal situations. So the core of the book is they have to find these Einsteins, who themselves don't know they're Einsteins, and recruit them in order to save the world. They find them, and, of course, they're complete idiots. So we have this guy, Frankie. And Frankie's from South Philly. If you know anything about the movie Rocky, you get an idea of what Frankie is about, because Rocky's from South Philly, a boxer, you know, Sylvester Stallone. He's a working class Italian, and he's actually offended to find out that he's Jewish all of a sudden, because he's a pretty proud Italian Catholic. He's got a gold chain hanging between his head and his, you know, little burly hairy chest. And he's not particularly bright. He owns a pizza shop. And then there's Jimmy up in New York City. He's kind of a hustler. Maybe he's smart. You know, he knows how to use numbers and such, but he's got the mob after him because he's ran into some problems with some payments. But he's a junkie. He's physically abused growing up, physically and mentally abused, and he's pretty much a mess. And you got this guy, Irwin. He ends up being I forget where Irwin's from, somewhere, God forbid, in the middle of the country, like Iowa or something, in some farmland. He has actually no intellectual stimulation growing up. His father, who's somewhat bright, dies at a very early age, and he's raised more or less by his obnoxious uncle, who just insists that anything somewhat intelligent that Irwin does is actually dumb, that this kid is an idiot. So he just grows up with incredible negativity. And then you got some somewhat positive action here. One guy, Jonathan J. the Fourth, he grows up and he's incredibly wealthy, a Mayflower family up in the Boston area. And then the smartest of the bunch is Alberta. It's a woman. Princeton, both her parents are Princeton professors. And this is, I tried to base the book largely in science, as bizarre as all this might be sounding. If you get over the fact that you can clone people and you can't. Alberta, this does happen. Alberta is female. Of course, she's biologically male. But for whatever reasons, during the pregnancy, she or he developed a rather small penis that was botched during a circumcision, and they had to make a choice to either leave the boy without a real functional penis, aside from urination, or convert this boy into a girl. And this was actually happening. This is a side conversation, but this has actually happened around 1970 with his fellow at Johns Hopkins. His name was Dr. Money, actually. And it was his theory that you can control the sex of a child. And there's a book, this is all serious, this is not part of the novel here. There's an actual a book called As Nature Made Him about one person who was converted to being female but wanted to be male growing up, finally understood what was going on, eventually killed himself because he was so messed up. But anyway, that's how Alberta is the female. So none of them are that smart except for the Alberta who was raised by preacher parents. And so they're recruited to save the world, and of course they can't. They go out, the White House gives up on them, and they go out to try to do this on their own. And the United States, in the meantime, doesn't know what to do because they don't know where this terrorist is, so they decide to invade Cuba because they can. You know, they got the public behind them, so a little parody of the Iraq War going on. So that's the book, and that's really what I wanted to present. And it's perhaps my prejudice that I think skeptics might lean more towards this idea that nature and genetics is more important. I don't think anyone on this conversation is probably going to think it's 100% one or the other, but I feel that a lot of skeptics that I've met feel that that nature and genetics is more important in determining someone's intelligence than nature is. And indeed, because it's kind of a wishy-washy thing, this idea of nurture, and it comes across as, you know, wishful thinking because you don't want to be considered a racist to say that one group of individuals is intellectually inferior than others and another. And there's a guy at MIT, Steven Pinker, that you might know, a linguist, but he has a book out called The Blank Slate. And it's his stance that genetics is mostly in play with everything that we do. The fact that I'm even having this conversation with you now is because of the genetic impulses inside me, and it's very little outside influence beyond that. Steven Pinker, you know, professor at MIT, and Chris Wanjek here, you know, a health science writer, so he's got the data and I don't. It's just that my stance is that chance plays such a part. When you think of life, and this is what I tried to say in the book, and this is probably how I'll just wrap up my little introduction here, that life is so full of trillions upon trillions of chances, even from the moment of birth. I mean, you think you are who you are, but it was a product of, you know, an egg and any one of, you know, billions of sperm, it's probably millions of sperm. But, you know, that conception could have been delayed by a second, and things would have been different, you know. If you just keep on working backwards, you know, you're in an elevator and someone sneezes and you get sick and you might have to go to the hospital and you see someone over there and you meet a nurse. And I mean, life just takes incredible different directions, totally on chance. And everything, I mean, the fact that you're listening to me right now means you're not in a car someplace else with the potential of meeting someone else and of having a child with that other person. And that's, it's so much chance going into everything you do. And then you're born, and you're supposed to have a soul, you know, according to certain religions, and because you were meant to be this way. But then more chances come in that take you in your life in any direction. And that's what all happens to all these characters. You know, Frankie, the South Philly guy, he's lifting weights, and, you know, he's a big bodybuilder kind of guy, only because he saw it one day on TV, because it happened to be raining and the baseball game was canceled and this thing was on instead. Or Alberta, you know, she's a feminist because she happened to stay at that house during college because she wanted to stay at someone else's house, but there was a storm and, you know, the line was knocked down, so she couldn't get through to that person, so she went up to the other person. And it utterly changed the direction of her life in the way she thought. And again, with Jimmy, he happened to get a girl pregnant. And it was just clearly by chance that somebody's parents were out of town because of a snowstorm, and they had a party at that parent's house, and he got a girl pregnant. And that altered his life completely. And it altered his chances of going to school. And all these kind of things utterly change our path and make us who we are. It comes down to chance and not so much genetics. And so finally, I say maybe the last slide. There's a study that you might want to take a look at. It's UK-based. I had a feeling that this program was UK-based, but I know it's quite more international. But nonetheless, this is an interesting study that's going on among twins in the UK, and they're finding how much chance plays in the role of intelligence and behavior. And across the UK, the study is more or less saying that about 40% of a children's behavior and intelligence is given to the location of where that person is. And that is even more extreme in London, because there's such diversity in London, all these different kinds of people. And that means these twins, that the twins themselves become more different from each other, because there's a greater chance in London of meeting different kinds of people. And there's greater influences on their life, and this radically changes their behavior at schools and their performances at school. So let me end it there. And it's probably a different kind of a topic or presentation that's done on this podcast, but it's really just my idea that the chance more so than genetics is playing a role, and I feel that our societies, our collective societies, is placing so much effort, so much focus on the genetic aspect of intelligence, the genetic aspect of health, and that we need genetic fixes to overcome, be it obesity or heart disease, or even medications to help kids learn better at school, trying to change their genome in that way. So let me leave it at that and open it up to just comments or questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. And I'm pretty sure Kitch will have some questions after that. Kitch?
Yes. Yes, actually, I do. I noticed on one of the slides, and this is actually more of my own interest, but one of the slides had Freddy Mice. Was that... By Justin, I'm not sure if you know a study about the agouti gene.
Yeah, that's right. You got the agouti
gene. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And for people who don't know about the agouti gene, the agouti gene is I think it plays a part in obesity. And I think the fatter of the two, I might have this backwards, but it's more or less the same concept, that there's a certain chemical called a methyl group, hydrogen and carbon. And in one animal, that group got affixed to this gene and shut it down, and therefore the gene couldn't express itself. And had it been expressed itself, again, I forget which way, it either would have controlled obesity or encouraged obesity. And that was the result of diet. And something similar was happening with the skin and the hair, the fur color.
Yes, as far as I remember, for that study, I remember it was covering in one of the lectures for molecular genetics.
Mm-hmm.
That the gene was the diet composed of folic acid and
yes,
which would donate methyl groups, I think helped to prevent the onset of the yellow color and obesity and different the greater the greater the folic acid content, the greater effect it had on limiting the obesity and yellow fur.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah, that gene, the yellow mouse, it stays on all the time, that gene, and it causes the yellowness and the obesity of that mouse.
The mouse they used was a mutant using I'm trying to remember an IAP promoter.
Right.
Which caused the gene to be constantly produced, but for the usually in mice, it's developmentally regulated. I just had to get that out because that's actually a paper I found pretty interesting when I was studying for the exams.
And I used it because it was an extreme example of what can happen. But in more recent studies, and it's relatively new, and nothing's conclusive here. But what you're doing in your lifetime, you inherit certain things, but what you're doing to yourself in your lifetime, in terms of food and perhaps even your intellectual pursuits, is altering this epigenome, and more scientists are thinking that that can be inherited. There was always this belief that the epigenome just kind of wipes clean and the pure gene gets passed down. But they're finding in animals that they can, like these mice, that they can have influence later in life. And there was also a sort of an unfortunate human study that had naturally taken place when the Germans had, at the end of World War II, imposed an embargo on parts of the Netherlands. And certain children, fetuses still in the womb, certain mothers were denied certain nutritions. And they've done studies on these children 40, 50 years later to show how different their genetic makeup is, and that there's the potential that they would pass along their susceptibility to diabetes or other diseases as a result of what happened to them when in the womb. So this is the idea of epigenetics affecting how we look and our health, but nothing yet really on intelligence.
Yes, and I actually find the whole area of inherited epigenetics kind of very interesting and be very fascinating to see how that will play in the evolution of organisms. See how that kind of epigenetic inheritance would influence.
Yeah, it's a brand new field.
Yep.
And I think this guy from Duke really helped launch it.
Okay, there is one question. I'm not too sure what he's referring to, but TC Unbeliever is asking, would you call this Lamarckian? I'm not too sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know that well enough, but I've seen that argument, so I guess the answer is a bit yes, and that if I wish that person could speak, but the idea is, you know, before Darwin, there was that concept that you may have heard that the reason why a giraffe's neck is so tall is because during its lifetime it has to reach higher and higher, and then that those changes during that giraffe's lifetime gets passed on. So it is very much like that, and it's not a question, I think, amongst scientists now of whether that's yes or no, but how much to a degree is it happening that the changes that are taking place during our lifetime are being, the so-called epigenome, are being passed down genetically to the offspring? Is it just a few percent or more?
And if that is long-lived, if it's only last a generation or two, or will it go be inherited indefinitely? That would be very interesting to see how much it is, how much to a degree, and how far it will go.
Yeah, they feel that, I mean, it's there could be so many factors behind this obesity epidemic, you know, and I'm one to think, as much as I'm talking about epigenetics right now, I'm one to think that it is our immediate environment that's making us fat. But there is this sense that children are at greater risk of obesity and diabetes than their parents were, given equal amounts of, like, identical nutrition. and it's because of some epigenetic influence from their parents' generation getting passed on to them that makes them even more susceptible. And as time goes on, our children are going to be even more susceptible to diabetes as a result of some changes that are taking place via the things that we eat. Speculative, but, you know, something that scientists are considering. I'm just amazed. I mean, in full disclosure, my day job, so to speak, is at the National Institutes of Health, where I'm the director of communications. It just fascinates me that so much money is being spent on obesity research from, you know, from at one point you think, well, it's just obvious, it's the food supply. But, you know, you have lots of really smart people thinking it's more complicated than just the easy access to a lot of calories. But it's down at a cellular level. There's something going wrong at a cellular level. And so you almost see, so going back to those fat mice and skinny mice, remember, they're given more or less the same diet. And one has a rather different outcome than the other because of something that has happened to its genome.
And Martimat.
Yeah, okay. I guess it's my turn then. I basically don't know a damn thing about genetics, so I really can't ask any intelligent questions that have to do with that. But what I can say is I'm a teacher, and during my education we spent a lot of time focusing on the whole, you know, why does it seem like some kids just can't learn anything? Like, what is it that makes kids, quote, stupid, unquote?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And others are obviously really intelligent. And, what you find is that there are connections between things like, your class.
Mm-hmm. Social class.
Example. Social class, yeah.
Yeah.
And how well you do in school. Things like that. So I'm thinking that there's probably, you know, yeah, genetics probably has a part to play in it, but it's very clear that people who go to school don't learn as much if they come from a home where, you know, they're basically worrying if they're going to be able to eat. You're not going to learn as much, and that's going to affect how well you do, obviously. And it's same thing if you if your parents are alcoholics, for example.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, and you're not going to do as well because there are other things going on than just can you focus on your studies.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to see, right now they've done a lot of studies on twins about this and identical twins separated at birth, which are kind of rare. I would like to see some studies, and it's probably going to happen soon, on adopted children. And I actually have an adopted child. I have a child adopted from China. And this is totally anecdotal, but I find it fascinating. When I look around, we're in a group of families who adopt from China, and we get to mix with these people. By and large, it's amazing. I mean, you have these kids that have no genetic connection to you, but you see kids in plump families starting to get plump, and children in wealthy families end up being quote-unquote more intelligent because they have better access to these schools. There's no genetic connection here. It's pure environment. It's pure their own parents' attitudes influencing these children on learning, and the money, of course, which is everything in the United States between, you know, a good no education and a decent education. And I'm fortunate enough, we only have the one child that, I mean, I wouldn't think of sending her to a public school here. So she's on
acceptance. I can understand why. Starting.
Yeah. So I think we're going to see some studies on this. And I think we're going to find, you know, these random groups of kids that from China, if you stick them in good, you know, wealthy or families whose parents treasure education, you're going to find that they're somehow smart. I'm seeing it evolve before me now, and that's what really is what influenced what I was writing with Hey Einstein. Yeah. All these kids are adopted. They know they're adopted. They just don't know they're Einsteins.
Do you have another question, Marty?
No, not really. That's what I kept thinking about the whole time, you know, the whole connection between book smarts, basically, and upbringing.
We have a kind of, I don't know if it's a question or a statement from the room, but I'll read it out anyway, from Grey Rook. Same genes but different code segments activated for different personality / spirit types. I don't know what he means by that.
Mm-hmm. Neither do I.
Well, I don't know, but it does, if you go back to the epigenetic idea, that there are genes, and let's see, how can I say this? All cells have the same genes, right? Whether it be a bone cell or, you know, a muscle cell. But clearly they're expressed in different ways. And what's doing that expression is the epigenetics. And we've talked a little bit about how nutrition can affect that and change certain cells, the muscle cell or the bone cell or the heart cell, to produce more fat or store fat or whatever it's doing. If you bring that up to this idea of neurons and brain cells, why isn't it possible then that at the epigenetic level, these outside influences could be shutting down certain elements and amplifying certain other elements of this basic blueprint gene that you have? So I guess that's my core argument, that the gene genetic component is a certain potential, and I feel that it's relatively equal among all of us in terms of intelligence, and it's what we put into the life that excites that or squashes that. And I like to say that from a bit of a wishy-washy stance, because I think if we don't agree that intelligence, that people really are equal in some way, it gets into these arguments of racism and whole continents that are somehow intellectually inferior. And so I tried to point out in the book very quickly that many of the so-called backwaters today, my apologies to people who live in these areas, but I think you probably know what I mean. I mean, Egypt and Babylonia and God forbid, you know, Greece and Nubia, you know, Kenya. I mean, these were the intellectual hotspots at one point. And you have the same genetic potential. All the same genes are being passed down, but now these people suddenly, you know, the mass of the population are off in a different direction because of various influences that are happening in those societies, be it poverty or whatever. And then somehow in America, I wanted to point out, you know, this land that took all the genetic refuge from Europe and elsewhere, that didn't have a chance in Europe and wanted to get out of there, they somehow, you know, we put a man on the moon, while, you know, places like Egypt can only listen to it on a radio because they didn't even have TVs. What happened there? If it's all about genetics, then Egypt and the great Greece, you know, should have stayed the leaders in terms of intellectual prowess. But it's global. Intelligence is everywhere, and it's how it's manifested.
Okay, we do have a caller. Jay, are you there? Hello, Jay.
Are you muted,
yeah.
Jay? Okay.
Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, you're through. You can speak to
Chris.
Do you have your blog?
Okay, you talk.
Yeah, carry on. Do you have your blog TV
yes,
on?
Yes, I already blocked it.
Yeah, it's muted. Okay, let's carry on then.
Okay.
Okay. Good evening. You are talking about the gene and how the strong effect in obesity. But I read last study, they said even if there is a huge effect of gene in obesity, but the lifestyle is the more strong than any gene effect in obesity specific.
Well, I certainly agree with that statement.
So what do you think?
Well, yeah, I think that's why I worry about this emphasis on genetics and search for genetic underpinnings of in this case obesity. We have seen even in diabetes as well. So in our introduction, you heard that I wrote this book called Food at Work, a totally everything else I write is relatively humorous, but this was a serious book about in the workplace about how workers have poor access to food and how it affects their long-term health. And when you look at, so I'm a bit of considered somewhat of a nutritional expert in the workplace anyway. And you look at places like I try to point out in my talks about this topic. You look at some place like Mexico, where diabetes is now the leading cause of death in diabetes, and it didn't exist two generations ago. You know, and now it's killing about 11% of the population. And so it's clearly not genetic that suddenly they have all these genes for diabetes. There's a change in the lifestyle that brought out this effect. And it's going to bankrupt that country, sadly, because they can't afford to pay for the long-term cost of diabetes and the eventual amputations that go along with this and the loss of work and everything along that lines. And the same idea with medications as well. They have found that there's diabetes drugs that do all types of, you know, have all types of bad side effects, but when compared, they're actually not as effective as lifestyle changes. The drugs try to attack the genome at the genome level and gene expression to alter what's going on there with the insulin resistance and all of that with diabetes and obesity. But they're finding that lifestyle changes are actually more effective than any of these drugs that you could possibly take. That's my end of my
story.
Okay.
Yeah, a second point.
About diabetes and specific the drugs, there is multi factors there. When you drugs absorption, it's just not affected by if you take the drugs, the right drugs, or not, or if you take it the right time or not, there is a lot things about the effect of the drug's absorption. I don't want to talk about that. But the major things is the bioavailability. The bioavailability is a huge effect by obesity. So if someone takes some drugs, it's will be work indifferent if you are obese or not. Just I want to say that statement. I am pharmacist, so I know that for sure. The next point about education. There is someone talk about difficulty in education in some difficulty learning in some children. I work with some difficulty learning children. But I find this, I observed this one, there is no stupid child. There is always a different way to approach every single child. Maybe
you might remember that I
maybe,
said, quote, yeah. Stupid, unquote.
Yeah, we're with you on that. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I think we need to be more differentiation between the two things, because people think sometimes if that child is stupid or not. In my opinion, there is no stupid child. Just we need to invent new way to give that child the information and give them how can deal with the learning process in funny and creative way. So anyway, thanks guys.
Mm-hmm. I would certainly agree with that. Yeah, thank you. And I would definitely agree with that point about education. And it unfortunately requires perhaps a lot of money or something you can't do at a public school. I don't know. But what I appreciate about the school that my daughter is now is they do have that understanding that children are learning differently. And so there are six different sections of this. The whole grade maybe has about 50 students, and there are five classes of about 10 each. But they split up on math and reading, and it's not as if they're tracked that the smarter ones are going in this one and the other ones are going here. They're actually understanding how these children are learning. And, you know, my wife is Japanese, and my daughter has this bilingualism going on right now. They understand that, and they're trying to understand how these children are learning so that they can all succeed as they move on. I do think, like the caller just said, that there's certainly mental retardation that goes on, but for the most part, I think we all have a certain level of intelligence, but that's going to get shut off at a certain time, whether it be negativity, whether it be physical violence, whether it just be lack of stimulation. These children, I won't even use the quote-unquote, my friend. I'll even say these children become stupid, and they lose the capacity to learn at a certain age, be it 10 years old or whatever, because of the influences that they had. They'll never get it if we don't help them in the beginning, and it's a nurturing thing going on there, not quite a nature thing. Again, my opinion.
I agree.
Talk about environment. You talk about environment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm talking about the environment and understanding.
You talk about environment.
Yes.
Yeah.
And understanding.
Yeah, I can understand this point from you. Even I can agree with you. The environment is a huge effect in the child, how it can absorb anything from learning process. I agree with you. I totally agree with you. But I'm talking just if there is the environment is similar, there is no such a thing called stupid child.
Mm-hmm. Okay? Thank you.
Bye.
I wanted to add one other thing, and I feel it's a limitation to my little theory here. Is that I have seen families, I have to be fair, and I think the skeptics appreciate this. I do see families, I have no explanation for this, but I see the end product, you know, children when they're 20 or 25 years old, as adults, radically different in intelligence and potential, even though they grew up in the same household. And that would imply that there's some genetic factors going in here to a certain extent. I mean, I grew up in Philadelphia, and I knew some generations, you run into some bad friends. So between two brothers, or the older brother might have had a certain circle of friends that had pervasive drug abuse, and the younger one didn't. And I can see how that happens. But I've also, in my own little anecdotal evidence, I have seen a family of four where one child becomes a CEO and the other child is an utterly underachiever, and the other children in plural. So what was going on in that one person's brain? Was it that just that person happened to connect to a certain coach or a certain teacher at the right time? Or was it something really genetic based that enabled, that this woman to actually succeed? I don't know. Again, I like to fall back in thinking that it's not it's more nurture than genetic, but I have no explanation to some of the things I see and some of the arguments that are posed against me. You guys are very kind. No one has really argued against my theory that Einstein would not be Einstein if raised differently, that cream always rises and the king is always going to be intelligent.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree, because it's perfectly consistent with what I've learned. So you're not going to get any arguments from me.
Okay, just a quick note, we're currently featured on the front page of Blog TV, so if you're looking in on the front page of Blog TV, please join the chat room. We're live with science journalist Christopher Wanjek talking about genetics and epigenetics, nature v. nurture. So please just feel free to dive into the room, ask any questions you want. There was one question from Organic Beekeeper. He says, or she says, I'm not too sure, male and female brains differ due to hormone doses in the womb. Is that an example of epigenetics?
Yeah, in a way, because the hormones turn on and turn things on and turn things off. I don't think I know enough about the topic to really say more about it, because it becomes a dangerous topic. We had a famous dean of Harvard who said that women just can't learn math, and there was a great outpouring of disagreement over that statement. And I tend to agree that women can do mentally all the things that men do, and it's a matter of a cultural thing going on right now, why there aren't more women chess masters or women in any given field that don't require extreme strength, like rugby or something. So I think the person who just submitted that question is getting to a good point, that the hormones, things floating around our body, will certain affect us in one way or another, and maybe that's why women and men have a certain direction in their life because of the hormones. That's what gets back to this guy. I forget his name. This guy, Dr. Money. It sounds so stupid to say his name like that, but that's what his name was. At the Johns Hopkins, who died only about 10 years ago. But that was his stance, an extreme stance, that it's hormones that dictate sex, and then you could change the person's sex by putting on a whole different set of hormones there and giving this man an Ersatz vagina or whatever it was and assume that this man turned a woman is going to grow up normal. It was a little more complicated than that.
So I just have to bring this up. Mm-hmm. While you were talking there, Jay was back in the chat room, and she's saying that she loves chess. So.
You go. You go, girl.
Okay, Kitch.
I'm sure she can. But hey, that was another. It's totally off topic, man. But I was in San Francisco at there's a certain park in San Francisco where people play chess in the park, and I used to think I'm kind of smart, but I was beaten every time by these prisoners, by these ex-convicts, essentially. These guys mastered chess, these derelicts of society who did their time, and are now out. They mastered chess in prison, and they just blew me away. I mean, blew me off the board. So I just thought that was interesting. And they are African-American, but I didn't come close to beating them.
It's just like how in South Korea everyone kicks ass at StarCraft.
Yes. Right. I mean, you got certain countries.
It's a cultural thing. I don't want to piss anyone off, but it's like the culture is obsessed with it almost, and then everyone becomes really good at it. I mean, it's obviously not genetic. Mm-hmm. What's the gene for knowing what to build to pick in what game? No, that's stupid.
Mm-hmm. Kitch?
Yeah. I'm just actually just trying to just come up with a question. I just know from actually my own experience, I do lab demonstrating, and it's generally, you can, just, maybe my sample's a bit biased here, but because it's a university setting, and usually if you get to 4-tier, you're pretty intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the theory. Although sometimes I wonder, with some of the horror stories I hear. But, so one thing I noticed coming through the university classes is that they're becoming more and more, there's more and more more women going into science than there has been traditionally.
Right.
Just even see it with, and that may be just these, just trying to get, I was up late last night. That didn't sound not that kind of way.
Yeah. But I don't know if I can finish a particular thought, and I don't want to cut you off, so come right back. But if you're getting at this point, which I've noticed that where I'm at, again, at the National Institutes of Health and in the sciences in general in the United States, you literally have about 50, if not slightly more, 50% of women in these hard sciences, in the biomedical sciences. Maybe not the hard sciences like physics. Let's stick with biomedical right now. So at the National Institutes of Health, coming in as graduates, recent PhDs, and postdocs, it's about 50%. And then they go on this tenure track process, and it gets down, I don't have the exact figures, but this is pretty close. It gets down to about 30%. And then at about 10 years down the line there, at the principal investigator level, where you're running your own lab at the National Institutes of Health, it gets down to about 10%. And that is not survival of the fittest going on. That is social factors that these women have to go through of when to raise a family, and caregiving responsibilities, whether it be taking care of their own parents or taking care of children, that they have to drop out of the tenure track, and they are less successful scientists as a result of that. They're equally brilliant as men going in, but once again, we're seeing the social factors at work in determining their so-called intelligence and their failures in life. And at age 40, they are the failed scientists. They have a PhD, and they don't have a scientific job. And it's not because of some innate quality in them. It was certain social factors. They could have been equally intelligent as any of those other women who might not have by chance had the certain responsibilities that they had to attend to, and certainly compared to men.
And I even found it during my own tutor, I do demonstrating in bioprocess engineering, which involves an awful lot of maths. Not very hard maths, basic integration, differentiation, and how to apply it to different kind of fluid flow systems and heating and mixing. And what I find is that the female students are easier can grasp the mathematics better than the males. Now, I'm not sure if that it's just a biased sample from just one university, kind of course. That's what I always found.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything like that in the literature? Is there more of a bias for women to be able to do the mathematics end of things? Or is that just complete another?
No, so I don't have this at my fingertips, but this had come up when that guy Sumner, the former dean of Harvard, had said that. And out came, it's not as if people created studies upon that statement, but they showed studies that did not support what he's saying at all. And I never collected these for my writing, so I don't have them. But I know that there are studies that show that, especially at an early age, before age 10, that girls are equally as competent in math, and that somewhere along the line, that is downplayed. And they, very subtle things that the school might do, but they are not encouraged to pursue a career or an intellectual path in mathematics. And it almost gets back to the statement about South Korea. I mean, you have certain pathways, and if you don't go in that pathway, that element that you have will never be expressed. And for many of these women, it becomes down to just a few people that happen to beat the odds and go against the social norms to go down that pathway and express themselves mathematically.
Okay.
Like I said, I've seen pretty much the same thing with when it comes to math and physics, that women just don't choose that. They don't choose careers
mm-hmm.
in those fields. But those who do, I mean, there's no difference
mm-hmm.
in how well they do and how well men do. But there is a obviously an overrepresentation of men in those fields.
Mm-hmm. Here's another little thing to chew on, and certainly in the biomedical field, one of our laments, or at many universities, is the dearth of African-American researchers. And you can say to yourself, why are there no African-American researchers in the biomedical sciences? Aren't they up to it? And again, you see the social pressures. They are succeeding as medical doctors. They're just choosing not to go in the research because, and the numbers are there. They're quite, and you might realize this now that I said it, there are many African-American medical doctors in practice, in surgery and all types of these things because it makes a lot of money. and these folks have a lot of time, if they're coming from a disadvantaged home, they have a hard time telling their parents they're going to go and research and be a postdoc and earn $30,000 a year for the next 10 years after, raking up all these tuition costs and then go into a career that's going to pay $70,000-$80,000 when they could be medical doctors and make their family proud. And you can even see this going way back to all types of groups coming to the United States, immigrant groups, that they first go to become medical doctors before they get into this weird position called a medical researcher. Fascinating stuff. Totally social. Nothing genetic going on.
Yeah, I even noticed that, funny enough, here in Ireland, there's PhDs and postdocs. Usually, PhDs usually get paid. I'm not sure. I think the situation in America is that you have to pay to do your PhD. In Ireland,
often.
In Ireland, it's actually the opposite way around because PhD students usually come in on different types of scholarships, or, for example, the Irish Research Council, Sound Foundation Ireland, to name just a few. And what I've noticed now with the recession and the way the state of jobs are, students are going into these more often, mainly because I know a couple of my own friends that were had no intention of doing a PhD, just wanted to get out, had to come back to do a PhD because they just couldn't get a job. And I think what we're going to see out of Ireland, I think, maybe partly due to this recession, is an increase in PhDs and postgraduate researchers.
Along those lines, people in the United States, you rake up a lot of loans, rack up a lot of loans in undergraduate, the 4 years after high school, from age around 18 to 22, if you want to go to a university, you're going to have to pay a lot of money. But those loans don't kick in if you stay in school. So there is the pressure to get a master's, even though you don't want it, because at least if the economy is bad, stay in school until there are more jobs out there and then push back the loan. It doesn't accumulate interest as long as you stay in school. So there is that pressure to stay in school longer and perhaps even rack up some more loans until the economy gets better and then you can find a decent job.
I'm just going to butt in here with we're still featured on the front page of Blog TV, so feel free to join in the discussion. Special guest Christopher Wanjek, just talking, Nature v. Nurture is the general topic. We'll take off topic questions, which leads me into this question, funnily enough, and it's from Angry Womble, and she's asking, we all love Womble. She's a unique individual, to say the least. She is asking, what's the most stupid bit of bad science that you can ever remember having to respond to in your career?
Okay. I got a couple. One, I'll tell you one incredibly touchy topic that I think is definitely bad science, and it's I'm relatively neutral on the topic of circumcision. There's medical reasoning for this. It's unnecessary at one level. Male circumcision, unnecessary at one level, but provocative. There's evidence you might know that it does at a very real level help prevent the spread of sexually transmitted diseases. So I wrote, I'm trying to think what I wrote. This is a couple of years ago, but I was reporting on a particular study. It was probably out of Africa that showed the effects of adult circumcision and the reduction. That was actually more successful than any HIV vaccine. And I had a quote from Anthony Fauci, the head of the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, the world's leader, and probably no one in this world knows more about HIV than this guy. And he said, you know, we would be dancing in the street if we had a vaccine that could work half as well as the circumcision is doing, or something along those lines. So, and then I also, so I wrote about that, and I got a lot of backlash that you're mutilating the penis and the whole works. Whatever. People will call me horrible things about being Jewish. I didn't even know it was really anti-Semitic stuff. I said, my name's Christopher, but nonetheless, it doesn't matter to me. It's pretty insulting, you know, that I'm part of some Jewish conspiracy to circumcise everybody. But I noticed this group that seems to compare male circumcision to female genital mutilation, or female circumcision is the clean name to it. But it's done for utterly different reasons. It's done for religious and cultural reasons, and it serves no medical purpose, and it actually is incredibly harmful to these women. And these men seem to. There are groups out there who hopefully aren't on the line who seem to equate with that and have formed their own groups, which I've written about and got flamed about, that, you know, they remember this happening to them and when they were 6 days old or wherever it was, and they still have these lasting scars, and they're going on, and they hate me. And so anytime I write anything about circumcision, which I think is generally can be a positive thing in terms of long-term health. I mean, there's better ways to avoid sexually transmitted diseases. There's condoms and there's celibacy and monogamy. But this is one way, and that's all. I just reported it from a simple medical point of view. But I think there's a lot of bad science out there about the effects of the mental effects of male circumcision on males today, that they have this lasting pain from it. That was one bit of bad topic. You know, some of the bad ones are just too rare to even worry about, like these people who drink human urine for health, urology, I think it's called. I've written about that. That's, you know, I bet how many people are doing that. I don't know, but there's a website out there that tells you how to do it and stuff. It serves no, it doesn't really hurt you, but it serves no purpose. They just think it's better. I think, so, okay, this, I'll end it here then. There's one thing that I just most recently, this probably should be posted today, I have a column on LiveScience.com that gets picked up by MSNBC and Yahoo and things like that. It's called Bad Medicine. And it gets into a little bit about this topic of raw foods and these people who, you know, vegetarian, you know, that's cool, and there's lots of reasons to be that way. I myself am not vegetarian, but vegan is the next step, and it makes a lot of sense to a lot of people from an environmental and an animal cruelty point of view. And then beyond that is something called rawism. That you do have the folks in the UK that are listening. That I believe there is quite a movement in the UK along these lines. It might even have started in the UK. If I remember correctly, there was one proponent of the raw food diet in the 1960s, and it took off from there. And this is the idea that cooking is unnatural, that the human body was never meant to cook, eat cooked food, and that cooking destroys all the vitamins and enzymes, they say, and that it's far more natural to have this diet that's just raw. And that's wrong on so many levels. It can work today, and I try to tell people, and they're very ardent. You know, you write something about this, you get loads of angry email. But the logic is so flawed on so many levels. And if anyone's out there on a raw food diet, please, I don't want to, you know, cut you off at all, but you're wrong on all these, you know, from a health level, you're going to lack certain vitamins. Even in a vegan, where they don't like to hear this, but you simply cannot get vitamin B12 on a vegan diet naturally, period. It's only in animal products. You're going to have an egg at least once a year or something, whatever it is. You're going to have an animal product or take a pill, and that's not natural. And there is no culture in this world that's a vegan culture, because you wouldn't exist. Okay, so at that very biological level, the veganism isn't going to work naturally. Only in the modern society can this happen, because you can take pills. And it can be a healthy diet beyond that. It can be far healthier than Christ, anything that, you know, that's happening in America with, you know, ham and fried chicken and all that. It can be healthier, but it's not, you can't say it's natural. And now what I just wrote about are two studies that show you can't even say the vegan and the raw diet are certainly natural from an evolutionary standpoint, because you may have heard of one of these stories, because it was out about a month ago, that essentially meat made us human, whether you like it or not. That there's the difference between humans and their other primates, you know, the size of the brain and the number of the neurons. So what this one very recent study has done has shown that you cannot support a growing, and from an evolutionary standpoint, the hominids that led up, you know, Homo erectus and things like that, they could not have been vegan and raw, because they simply would not be able to consume enough calories. And that's what happened to the gorilla. The gorilla is vegan and raw, and the gorilla is three times larger than us, but has three times fewer brain neurons, because they have to consume, they have to eat all day long, essentially 80% of a 12-hour daytime, just to consume enough calories to support their bulk. And the brain, this group probably knows, uses up a lot of energy, 20% of energy of the body at rest, and it only makes up, you know, like 2% of the body mass. So it's a huge expense, this brain. And the only way for humans to have, pre-humans to would have feed a growing brain was to start cooking food, because that opens up a whole new range of things you can eat, and the amount of nutrients you can get out of that and calories you can get out of it. You suddenly can eat more of a plant and not just the tender, tiny little top part that you would have been able to digest otherwise. And meat. That meat was all over the place in the savannah. And that the first study was about the amount of calories that would be needed for the primates' calorie per neuron development. And the gorilla would have had to eaten an extra 2 hours a day, which would have been impossible, in order to have a brain, develop a brain like a human did. And human beings would have had the pre-humans, excuse me, would have eaten 9 hours, consistently eating 9 hours of raw vegetation every day, which is just biologically impossible because you would have to gather that, you would have to look for predators, it wouldn't be enough range you would get around to be able to gather all that food. So clearly pre-humans were doing something else. And then the second study showed how 1 million years ago, this certain infant hominoid, about 2 years old, right at the weaning stage, had certain deficiencies you could tell in the fossils. This is a pretty open shut case, the way the pores, certain porous spongy material in the fossil. Clear-cut indication of a vitamin B9 and B12 deficiency in a type of animal that would require meat. So this was pretty clear that those our ancestors were eating meat, about 1 million years before the dawn of humankind. And if they didn't, we might not have developed the kinds of brains that we had. So I thought the weird kind of bit of pseudoscience is the raw food issue that can only work. These people think it's natural, but it can only work in this modern day of refrigeration to get things year round. But the funniest thing about this is everything they eat is modern. They're not eating wild things. They're eating carrots, which was only developed a few hundred years ago, or green peppers, and all these things. These modern vegetables have only been around for a few hundred years at most, and that's what they're eating. But they're claiming that it's evolutionarily the way it should be to eat raw foods. That's all. I'm done with my little soapbox.
I just want to also ask, and maybe it's a stupid question, but does the raw food diet also, is that just vegetarian only?
Yeah, no, it isn't a dumb question, because I thought that, because I eat raw fish. I've actually had some nice pieces, sounds disgusting, but a raw beef tongue, right in the middle there, it's really tender, from a farmer's market. But that's not what they're talking about. They're eating things, raw vegetation. It's also possible because they blend things. It's another thing that ancestors couldn't have done. But they blend it to release all these various nutrients.
And with the raw food diet, I would imagine also be into organic farming as well. I would imagine, is that also true, or am I?
Yeah, no, it gets right. Because you see how it quickly becomes more of a social thing than a scientifically logical sound thing. It's the same crowd. Yeah, it's organic, and I think organic is great. But again, as a nutritionist, I don't see the disadvantage of the opposite of that, inorganic food or conventional food. I think organics are great, but I don't know if you can feed the world on them right now. But there's nothing wrong in going in that direction. I think local foods are more important than organic foods. I think there's something obscene of flying in organic apples from New Zealand. As much as I love New Zealand, there's something wrong with that when you could have a local apple from 5 miles away in Baltimore.
Yeah. I suppose this will lead me into a question. I know Kit is quite passionate on this subject, but I suppose what's your opinion on GMOs then?
It's like any Frankenstein kind of thing. If you do it well, it's good, right? It's whether you trust Monsanto and some of these big DuPont, some of these big companies. I guess I don't have a strong informed opinion other than to say that I see the fear that some people have, and I can't really assess how rational that fear is. I think some level of fear is rational, but I worry about. I think there are some rational things. In terms of genetic, I don't think it has much to do with our health. I don't think that a genetically modified crop is going to have some great adverse effect on our health as long as you eat a balanced diet and such. I think that one of the larger fears that I might have would be the biodiversity issue. And if they continue to make a strain, let me backtrack. They did so things so wrongly with weed control, right, that, you know, they created these crops that were resistant to certain types of pesticides, so that you could dump pesticides on there, kill all the weeds, but not kill that very crop. But now there has been enough mutations taking place among those weeds that the weeds are becoming resistant to the pesticides as a result of these efforts. And I think along these same lines, the GMO foods, we run the risk of changing the genome in such a way that sets us up for completely wiping out, you know, the whole crop of corn. If you're going to be dependent on a certain type of strain of wheat or corn or what it might be, and a new kind of fungus comes along, it could wipe out that entire crop because you've limited your genetic diversity and trusted this so-called superfood that was supposed to be resistant to all these things. I would advocate for a greater diversity of natural crops, because the more you manipulate the genome on your own, you start removing things from the gene pool. And this is the argument that goes along with the heirloom varieties of plants, heirloom tomatoes and heirloom this and that, that there's such a greater genetic diversity that should some fungus come along, like the fungus that wiped out all the elm trees in the United States, that there would be some surviving members that could move on for the next generation. If that makes sense.
So I think
I'm not going to be one who protests, you know, and throws rocks at the people doing the GMOs, but I, at a very minor level, I do understand their concern.
I think, Kitch, you're the best one to follow this one up.
Yes. As far as I'm aware, the way the GMO is made is that the addition of a gene. I'm just trying to just synthesize all that.
Yeah, I can see where you're going.
In terms of the actual safety of them, they are well regulated in terms of their actual danger to human health. Like that's one of the main areas that really irks me when it comes to GMO. However, for the outside of the toxicity, I can see some issues with it, especially in India, where Monsanto, is it Monsanto that's selling the GMOs in India, and Indian farmers are in poverty. Because they have to, once they start planting the GMOs, they have to continuously buy the seed from Monsanto, and Monsanto will put the price up, which is obviously just terrible.
Right.
That's how Monsanto makes their money. So I always try to think of, when I come to GMO, debating GMO, so I always try to separate Monsanto from the actual research, because Monsanto is a company, and its profit, well, research is driven by a desire to actually do good, you know, depending on the researcher. But most researchers are in research to make a difference, to do these sorts of things. But there are concerns over GMO, legitimate concerns, but that's more to do with the companies, the actual companies themselves, rather than the actual research. The diversity, I'm not really too sure on itself, because I think now that I've got it a bit out, they're not really. The GMOs are contained into a certain field, and there'll be one gene added to it, So if a new fungus came along, if those crops will still be wiped out. But never mind. I see what you mean. Keeping a non-variety of GMOs out there would, you know, they'd be more genetically diverse. I know what you mean by sexual reproduction. Sorry, I just had a brain fart.
Mm-hmm.
If that sort of thing happens. But that is actually a legitimate concern as well. So I wouldn't advocate for total GMOs, you know, or using GMOs mm-hmm. for just having them. There should mm-hmm. be a legit. There should be a reason to have them around, and definitely keeping a genetic livestock as well. I hope that made sense, because sometimes I just have a tendency to ramble.
No, it made sense to me, and it comes down to the nefarious nature of certain companies. I mean, and there's an interesting argument about the food supply. You know, everyone wants it to be local and organic, but who's going to grow it? And so our modern society has freed up the farm so that people don't have to spend their whole life growing food, that only a very smaller and smaller portion of people grow all the food for the rest of us. And maybe there's a certain line to be crossed. You don't want it to be too few people. But at the same time, a lot of our lives, we're having this conversation on Skype because of decisions that were made 100 years ago that freed up more people from the farm to pursue other kinds of activities. And in doing so, industrial farming made that possible, whether you like it or not. I think some people feel that it's gone too far. But at some level, I think we can be proud of a lot of our food distribution and the amount of the bounty that we can grow from one land.
Yes, I definitely feel that the fear sometimes has gone too far. I've actually seen some just terrible arguments against the safety of GMOs. From Natural News, that terrible website. I think they call him the help. Trying to remember his actual name, Michael something or another. I remember I did a video on it.
Mm-hmm.
And he used a study where plants, microRNA from plants, can enter into the bloodstream and cause, can bind to receptors on liver cells and cause and alter slightly the cholesterol uptake. And he took that and twisted it into GMOs can cause huge manipulation to organs.
Yeah, I remember that.
Which I stumped. I'm still stumped, actually. I'm still gobsmacked over that.
Well, it's a radical new idea, and I think any new radical idea is accompanied by a certain healthy dose of skepticism, whether it be rational thinking or just utter fear, I don't know.
Okay, got a question from the chat room from Organic Beekeeper asking, could humans be modified to make vitamin C?
I guess my question would be why. I love oranges. I don't know. Dogs can generate it, right? I'm not one to say no to anything. I guess that could happen. It's just a matter of why would it need to happen and what would be the impetus for someone to start doing that. Maybe a deep sea, a deep space voyage, right? You know, like the sailors cutting across the sea and not having the lines and getting scurvy. Maybe there's some space reason for that. I don't want to trivialize the question, but it seems that certain animals can generate it. So in theory, you would think that you might be able to enable a human to generate it, but for what reason, I don't know.
Okay, this is just one question I had off the top of my head. You probably encounter a lot of you know, the alternative side of medicine. Mm-hmm. I mean, and we know they can be a bit, well, nuts, to be honest. Well, which are the ones that have had the most just over-the-top reaction to what you've written?
Let's see. I think Falun Gong. Are you familiar with Falun Gong?
Never heard of it.
That's good.
I have.
Falun, I thought it was, had a presence in London as well, but it comes from China, Falun, F-A-L-U-N, Gong, G-O-N-G. This much is true. They're persecuted in China, largely because they're wacky. They held protests outside various Chinese embassies, certainly the one in the United States and Washington. And they have this, but the funny thing about Falun Gong is because they're protesting against China, and because China has persecuted them, and because China is considered by many people to be evil in whatever respect, that you have a lot of liberal Americans liking Falun Gong and going along with this bizarre belief system of it's a modern invention of Tai Chi and some of the more things that I do believe have therapeutic effects in Qigong and certain elements of Chinese medicine. But Falun Gong takes it to a whole different level that I tried to explain in an article in the Washington Post as the protest was going on in support of Falun Gong, that some entity lives within you that has these arms and it rotates in a certain way inside your gut in a different dimension, and it keeps things in balance, and you have to do these crazy exercises with your arms in order to power the spinning of it. If any American understood the basis of this, they would just run away from it. But instead, you got these people in the park to this very day, outside the Smithsonian area in down in Washington D.C. They meet every weekend and they do these bizarre looking exercises that are kind of a watered down Tai Chi. If they were Tai Chi, that would be great because that's very controlled movement. And that there's some very good studies to show how good that is for Parkinson's and certain balance problems. But this is just some bizarre weird thing you do with your hand, and all these Americans are doing it. And I wrote about that, and the Falun Gong people, yeah, of course, they were being persecuted because they think they can live forever and just by doing these things. If you're doing it right, then you should be able to live 400, 500 years. The fact that you're not living that long is because you're not doing it quite right, so you got to practice more. So that was one bizarre thing that that had some resistance. I'm trying to go through some of the homeopathy, of course. I'm fascinated by homeopathy. Clearly, I don't believe in it, and I try to explain people what it's all about. I mean, there are high priced shops in Boston around Harvard Square that sell this stuff, and it boggles my mind. If anybody understood that, maybe this group understands. I don't know if I'll get much resistance. That, I mean, it's by definition, you know, sugar water or whatever.
No, it's water.
Say there, kind of in the UK, we've got entire kind of homeopathy facilities on our National Health Service here.
Right.
Like millions being spent on these. Like, and I think did you see Richard Dawkins' Enemies of Reason documentary?
Yes.
Yeah, he kind of explained it better there.
Right. And I have written stuff quite recently because I know Europe is finally backing away. I think Switzerland, where Switzerland might not support it anymore. I think there's been a lot of rattling in the UK that this can't be supported by the public health system. But what I found fascinating, I guess this gets to Michael Shermer's book of I forget the actual name, but Why Do Smart People Believe Dumb Things, something along those lines. And anyone who knows the actual title should speak up. But
it's Why Do People Believe Weird Things.
So yeah, okay, good. This story never ran for the Washington Post because I became too empathetic with the homeopaths that the Washington Post thought decided not to run it. But I visited a pharmacy, and these people, more so than any other, so much alternative medicine, they're clearly quacks. They're clearly out to get money. The homeopaths, from what I've found, I've talked to a lot, they are good people. They just believe this. They really believe in it. They are not trying to steal anything from you. They just really believe in it. I went to the pharmacy, and this guy's explaining what's done. And he said, yeah, I know. It doesn't make any sense. But we give it to animals. I mean, I was a farmer, and I had, you know, this is what the guys tell me. I had sheep, and they were sick, and I gave it to the sheep, and they got better. I mean, what do the sheep know? But the sheep are better. They don't know anything about a placebo. And he's going on, and I could see, and other people, there's researchers that are into this, and they're smart, and for the most part, you know, and the ones I actually talked to, I got a sense that they're very good, warm people who want to help people and believe in this product. So it's a bit different than the question that was asked of me, what do you get the most resistance from? The homeopaths often don't come back to me with hate so much, but you really just don't understand. Almost like a cult. You really have to be a part of this to believe. I don't know. But again, they're very, the ones I talk to are very, seem like very good people. So I always found that interesting.
No, it's quite strange you say that, because one of the first videos I made on YouTube was about homeopathy, and that got a lot of resistance. Mm. In fact, the guy I was critiquing filed a copyright claim against me.
Oh.
And it took years to resolve it, and, you know, finally I got the video was restored. And it's quite weird, on his channel he complains about people censoring homeopaths, and that's what he tried to do to my critique.
Nice.
So, and I suppose one question... Oh, sorry, Kirch, you speak?
Sure, I was going to ask, just on balance, what is the... What are the Stein's articles that have made you the most excited? What science made you just do a double take and think, really, is this actually possible? You know, the good science stories.
Yeah, good question. In terms of alternative medicine or anything?
Anything, really.
Okay, because, well, quickly then on alternative medicine, I do see some real things on, and some very promising things on acupuncture. And as strange as that sounds, it gets to a level where you might not be able to deny it anymore, that there's certain, that something is going on. And at some level that makes sense to me, because I disregard any alternative medicine that just violates physics, okay, like homeopathy or distance healing, you know, things like that. No, end of conversation. But you are pressing things in acupuncture, and could it be that we simply don't understand what's going on, but something is going on, and that and the Chinese did have some sense. I mean, I had seen some demonstrations at MIT, at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, of all places. I was right there with Fraud, who was a real researcher, who was finding these electrical currents in that happened to be spot on with the pressure point, those points on the body that are in these ancient Chinese maps. And there might be certain flows that of electrical impulses that might do something. I don't know. So I find more and more that I'm coming closer to the fact that acupuncture, there might be something to a certain level of what can be done with acupuncture. Beyond that, I've seen some interesting things with stem cells, and that I do think, I mean, years off, 20 years off before major therapies, but that seems to be immensely promising. And of course, somebody, that Chinese fellow, Yamanaka, just won the Nobel Prize for the iPS cells, the pluripotent stem cells that are adult that can be reversed to an embryonic stage and then branch off into something new, that has a lot of promise, but a little bit scary too, because it seems too simple to be true. But nonetheless, I see positive after positive study on stem cell therapy, whether it be adult stem cells or embryonic stem cells, of being able to cure diseases that you never thought would be able to be cured, reverse blindness. I think that's happening right now. Certain kinds of blindness are being reversed as a result of stem cell studies in the retina. So that blows my mind. Whether we could regrow organs, I don't know, but there was that guy in North Carolina, name eludes me right now, but he's starting to grow these from stem cells, these organ, small patches of organ tissue, certainly skin, and getting into liver and some other organs on a very microscopic scale, but nonetheless, it's where it has to start. I'll stop there.
Yeah, Womble's got another question. It's, what's the most crazy piece of science you've ever had to go and report on, as in what you just said, oh my God, this is just nuts?
I would say Falun Gong, because I went in there, as a good reporter should be. I went in there innocently. I had no idea what this was about, and it was the Washington Post that assigned me this story. This was probably around the year 2000, but it's still going strong now. And that story, I dare say, might have made some difference in the way people think, and certainly the way Falun Gong operates. Because at the time, you were able, and I told people to take a look at this so you know what you're getting into, but you could get the manual essentially online and get this. There had to be some huckster. I couldn't get a hold of the guy who created this system. He's an exile from China, and he was living in Queens and in New York, and no one could get a hold of him. But he has essentially this explanation of Falun Gong in all its glory. It was online in both Chinese and English, and I was able to show passages that were just absurd. And sure enough, if you look now, you won't find these books available online, because the Falun Gong people realize how dumb this might sound like to the normal person. So they don't make these things available anymore. I have it. Maybe I can email it to folks. And it explains the origin of it. It's so bizarre on so many levels of this intelligent. It's like an alien invading your body. It's some intelligent. I'm trying to think of the wording they used. Intelligent being in a different dimension, in your gut, spinning in a certain direction that you have to keep on spinning for good health. And it gets a little bit into the Chinese stuff of balance and yin yang and such. It's just so utterly bizarre. And then of course you see it all the time, the testimonials. I had cancer, now it's gone, I grew back a foot, whatever. There's people just coming up, right, with the Monty Python thing. She turned me into a new, got better. So,
and interesting, all these testimonies still has that $1 million check.
Yeah, right. So that, hands down, that would be the most bizarre thing I was asked to report on. No one asked me to report on urology, that idea of drinking urine, but doesn't do anything good or bad, but I'm trying to go through a quick list here, and I can't think of anything more bizarre than Falun Gong.
Going back to some good science, I'm guessing you've interviewed quite a lot of scientists. Which scientist in particular has stood out the most? Like, who are you most impressed with of all the scientists you've spoken to?
Well, let me start by a general statement. So before about 10 years, I was a contracted writer with NASA, yeah. And my beat was high energy astrophysics. And I found these guys to be really fascinating. And they had all the time in the world for you because, you know, they're building experiments that are like 10 years away and we might fail. So, I mean, they got time. And for the most part, astronomy means nothing in society. It serves no purpose. So they're very willing to make their case of why what they do is so fascinating. So I could have nice long conversations with these people. Really smart and really mind-blowing stuff about black holes and such. I've never tired of that. And then when in dealing with doctors, medical researchers, the exact opposite. I don't have time for you. I'm about to save someone's life. Let's make this quick. So it was hard for me to really relate so much to the medical researchers. Certainly no one famous stands out. I have interviewed, I just lost his name, Andrew Weil, he's alternative medicine. Are you familiar with this guy? He has a big, fluffy, gray beard, bald head. Is he just an American phenomenon?
He must be American.
He's pretty big here. Deepak Chopra. He was really, I guess that's the ostracized. He's really difficult to talk to. Very cagey. If you ask him really intelligent, almost challenging questions, he doesn't know how to answer them because he can't give you the typical spiel. He knows he's wrong. And you're like, I can't fool him. What do I do? Maybe I'll just change the topic. But Andrew Weil, Weill, I found him to be incredibly rational and practical. He comes across as he's, you know, positioned as the alternative medicine guru and nutrition based and yoga and all the good feel kind of things. And he has a very prominent website. But if you get into that and I'm talking to him, he's a really good person. He had a fascinating past. I don't think he dropped out of Harvard, but he was at Harvard Medical School in the 1960s with that whole LSD era, and he did a lot of drug research, and he claimed, you know, he says he's done just about any drug there is, and he got into that whole idea of peyote and mind-opening experiences and things, and he's written some books that are, you know, certainly controversial at the time, late 60s, early 70s, about the importance of mind-opening drugs, and he eventually found his way into alternative medicine. So he never had much credibility. Brilliant guy. I mean, he was at Harvard Medical School. But he never had much credibility in mainstream science. But I've grown to appreciate him. I don't see how people could really, if you look through his stuff, he's really practical with his advice about, you're sick. Yeah, I mean, there's certain teas you can drink and all that. But if it doesn't work, you know, go see a doctor. he doesn't like so many other people, assume that you can, just happy thoughts will make you better. He's not at that level. He's very rational, so I grew to have a respect to him. I thought he was a fascinating individual. I talked to him on several different occasions. I think one of the last times I talked to him was somebody created this, you'll love this, patch that you put on the back of the cell phone to absorb the cell phone radiation. So cell phones are no longer dangerous because this patch absorbs all the transmission that gets out. And it lasts forever. It never fills
up. I've seen commercials for that one on YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
Well, for me, I'm a technician and I used to work on cell phones, so that's going to...
I don't know if this is the same product.
Background in physics.
This might not be the same product because this was at Whole Foods, which is an organic kind of store in the United States. Rich clientele, wealthy clientele anyway, upper class. And Washington Post, again, sent me to investigate this because the stupid owner bragged to the Washington Post, you should write a story on my product. And so they sent me, the bad medicine guy. And the product claimed that somehow Andrew Weil endorsed this. So I called Andrew Weil. He was furious. That's bizarre. Who was this? And then we never heard of the product again. So I don't know. They had some type of out-of-court settlement. So that's why I feel that he was just a good guy, Andrew Weil, and a fascinating guy, even though, well, I mean, he can really convince me that, you know, that I think nutrition goes a long way. He probably helped my thinking that, you know, like I was saying about diabetes, I mean, lifestyle changes is definitely more successful in managing diabetes than drugs that will mess up your liver. And I'm not anti-drug, but I think he was fascinating guy in putting my mind to that.
I think this will be the last question. We've got a chat room question. Organic beekeeper again. What does Chris think about organic molecules discovered in space?
Oh, yeah. Well, I find that's no surprise. We're not talking about life, right? We're just talking about things that are organic.
Yeah.
And that was never my, by the way, my beat or specialty. And I still do write about astronomy. It's always high-energy astrophysics stuff and not the at the molecular level. But I have a good friend who will be coming over for Thanksgiving in a couple days, an astronomer, a Japanese guy. And he has been studying various organics. I wish he were on the phone, but he's not. But on Mars and in space, this is nothing new as far as I'm concerned. There's vinegar in space. There's all these different organic things in space. It's just a matter of they can't do much in space. But clearly, it's out there, and when it settles on a habitable planet, wonderful things might happen, or horrible things like here. All right.
I think it was when I watched You Know History's Universe series.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I watched
one
of The Universe. That's all it's called. It's on the History
mm-hmm.
Channel.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one of their episodes when they were talking about giant beer clouds in space.
Yeah, you're trying to get something that people can relate to.
And of course,
to,
like, you know, being a Scottish guy, my eyes just lit up at the thought of that beer clouds.
I'm going.
Yeah, get me on that rocket right away. Okay, I think we're drawing to a close. So, Chris, if you want to promote any work of yours or promote your blogs, now's your chance to go on the soapbox again.
No, I got nothing. So you might find that if you think I'm somewhat entertaining, take a look at Hey Einstein. I think you can get the Kindle version rather cheaply for, you know, $2 or $3 US. I'm not sure. Or a hard copy. It's print on demand. So if you order it on various places like Amazon, they'll mail it to you. And I like the concepts that you heard. That was the original point of this conversation. I think it's a fascinating idea, if I say so myself. This idea that, you know, a living experiment with Einstein clones out there, five of them, six of them, whatever it might be, running around and really not living up to the original Einstein and having all these social issues because of what's happening to them in their lives. I just think it's an interesting concept, and I think the beginning of the book is pretty compelling. I think it gets tighter at the end. You'll have to wade through the middle, because I tell people it's hard to write a novel.
Yeah.
I remember always writing these little, 1,000, 2,000 word news articles.
Yeah.
It's a whole big middle part of the book you have to fill up with things, but hopefully it'll open up. I don't want this to sound pompous, but I wanted to kind of start a discussion,
yeah,
you know, in society about genetics and what I feel is this over-reliance on everything is in my mind, everything is getting to be all about genetics, and it's less about personal choice and lifestyle and the choices that you make in life or the choices that happen upon you. And that scares me that we're starting to think that things are beyond our control, that it's a fate, and your genetic fate will determine who you are, and that's I think when we go in that direction, we lose a bit of our humanity. That's all.
Okay, great. Anything from Mortimer or Kitch to finish up?
No.
Just want to thank Chris for calling in and coming in and this interesting talk.
Yeah.
Good. It was more fun than I could imagine.
Just to let everyone know, we're back same time next week with some guy called Matt Dillahunty. I don't think any of our regular listeners know who that guy is. It's totally unknown to you.
Oh.
But also, just 1st of December, we have one that Kitch is looking forward to, Michael Nugent, President of Atheist Ireland. If you tune into that, we'll also have the announcement of next year's charity show. We'll officially announce it then. And like I said, you check the Facebook and everything else, you'll see we've got our full schedule. We are booked solid up till February, and there's so many cool things happening. So everyone in the room, as I said earlier, we can't put our hands together really in the chat rooms, but thumbs up for Chris for a fantastic talk. It's been great.
Yeah, likewise. I really did enjoy talking to you guys, and maybe we'll get together again sometime.
Oh, yes, definitely. So thank you very much, everyone, for tuning in, and we'll see you again same time next week. Good night.
Good night.
Bye.